On this week's 51%, a woman helps create a website to mourn loved ones in a time of social distancing.
You know, people that have lost somebody, that can't mourn, that can't have a funeral together, that can't have traditional services, I think they're really looking for a community right now.
Hear how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting families financially, from a hair salon owner to military families. And Dr. Jerry Burns reflects on an unintended positive impact of the pandemic. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
You're in the arms of the angel. May you find some comfort here.
When you type in mourningamerica.org, a page comes up with hundreds of circles, some with photos, some just solid red with names in white, and some marked with the medical emblem signifying healthcare workers, all who died during the coronavirus pandemic. Doctors Rebecca Heiss and Dermot Jevons, a New York-based couple, wanted to give Americans a way to mourn loved ones in a time of social distancing, stay-at-home orders, and when public and private gatherings are being restricted. 51%'s Elizabeth Hill spoke with Heiss, an evolutionary behaviorist, about the site and more.
Well, we were sort of laying around the house lamenting about, you know, the fact that we felt really helpless and scared and sad and really angry about everything that was happening, and looking around feeling like, what can we do? You know, we can wash our hands, we can stay inside. But like so many Americans, we kept watching this number rising on the screen and feeling like there needed to be faces to these numbers. There needed to be names, there needed to be stories. And I turned to my partner and I said, you know, we should build a memorial. And I come up with a lot of sort of crazy ideas. And when he turned and he's like, yeah, I knew we were onto something. And so I stayed up until probably 3 that morning coding a really basic sort of skeleton site. And the next day we were off to the races, started to build the site by looking in the newspapers, trying to find names, obituaries, any sources of information that we could find, listening to the news, pulling names from the news, and started to build the site and ended up getting to the point where we needed to hire a professional, because I am certainly not a technical coder or developer by any means. And so we hired a developer and then spent the next 3 weeks, literally 8 to 10 hours a day, just finding names and adding them.
What has been the public's reception to your mission?
Well, for the people that it's reached, we've had a really positive reaction. I think this is really needed right now, especially as we're separated. You know, this is not natural for humans to be so isolated, and people are craving communities. You know, people that have lost somebody, that can't mourn, that can't have a funeral together, that can't have traditional services, I think they're really looking for a community right now. And so that's what we've built, is a place where people can come and share those stories. It's been really positive. It's been really rewarding to see families that feel like their loved one is going to be remembered.
When you were combing through obits, did you reach out to families to get pictures, to get stories?
We haven't done that. We're actually just starting to do that now. We wanted to be really respectful of, you know, these are families that have just lost somebody very dear to them.
Right.
At the same time, you know, we want to make sure that they're not lost in memory. And so we have sort of actually relied on news to help us spread the word about this message. And we're just pushing it this week, honestly, to the news, to try and help get the word out. But the one way we have been reaching out to families is if they have a GoFundMe page. We've reached out to them on the GoFundMe and said, hey, if you want to memorialize your loved one here, you can do it as well on this site, and, you know, post your GoFundMe, because we're a nonprofit. We're not asking for donations of any kind. And if people are looking to donate to us, what we want them to do is go onto the site and find a family that could use their help.
And I noticed you are highlighting healthcare workers who passed.
Yeah, we are. You know, we want to sort of designate those that are on the front lines and helping us all get through this pandemic. And it was a hard decision, actually, because what we realized as soon as we highlighted the healthcare workers is, man, we need to highlight the grocery workers. We need to highlight the custodial workers. We need to highlight, there are so many, the deliverer, you know, the people that are delivering food and packages. And there are so many people that are putting their lives at risk just so that we can operate still as a society. And I wish that we could designate, you know, special markers for all of these people. Our hope is that their loved ones, their families, will come on and put a picture behind the name so that we can hear and learn more about them. We're hoping that it reaches more. You know, we've built this community as a spot where we're saying, look, we're here to help, but we need your help to build this memorial together. Because after all, as you know, we're all in this together.
And how do listeners submit loved ones that they have lost?
Great question. Thank you. It's a very simple submission form. If you go to mourningamerica.org, and that's mourning, MOURNING, mourningamerica.org. There's a simple submission form that says submit a loved one's story. You click on that form. It'll ask for the name, the story, a picture of your loved one, and you can decide whether or not you want to share your name or information on the site. We will publish it as quickly as it comes in, and it'll be on the site and available for people to share their comments or stories or happy remembrances of the person.
In addition to Mourning America, you are the CEO and founder of iQuity, which is releasing a mobile app in June. Can you explain your organization's mission?
iQuity is a way for people to better understand themselves. We want to help the world see themselves as the world sees them, to raise our level of self-awareness. One of the reasons, and I know your audience is geared for the 51%, and I'm really excited about this, because one of the missions of iQuity is specifically to help women understand and rank themselves more accurately. If you look at leadership positions, again and again, females rank themselves lower than their colleagues would rank them on positive traits, whereas men do the exact opposite. So part of the mission here is just helping everybody see themselves as the world sees them, so that we can all begin to lead from our actual strengths rather than what we perceive our strengths to be.
Which gender is more open-minded about changing these inherent behaviors?
That's a great question. And I don't know that that has a gendered answer, to be honest with you. I think both genders can be open to change. And the whole idea of iQuity is actually not to change who the person is, but rather to make them aware of how everybody else sees them. So the way iQuity works is a user will rate themselves on specific traits that they're interested in. So perhaps I want to know how empathetic I am, or how funny I am, how humorous I am. I would rank myself on those traits, and then I would have others rate me anonymously on those same traits. So I could see where everybody else saw I was and compare that to how I think I am. So the idea is not for everybody to be a 10 out of 10 on humor, a 10 out of 10 on empathy. It's to be aware of where you are as the world sees you. Because that's how you can understand your true strengths when it comes to leadership.
I'm curious as to why you got into this form of self-help.
I honestly think it's because I saw so many female leaders, and as a female myself, recognizing that a lot of the time I would go up in front of, you know, public speaking, for example, which is, I'm now a professional speaker. That is what I do for a living. And I never saw myself as a strong professional speaker. The first time when I started doing these gigs, I would get ratings from people and I was like, no way. No, I didn't do that well. And what I recognized was that my perception of myself was so different from the perception of others in so many different categories. I thought, you know, there's something really important here. And in looking at, you know, how leaders do well in the world, self-awareness is the number one quality that people are looking for in a leader. And there's no good measure of it. There's 360 reviews that, you know, leaders might be able to get once a year, maybe, if they're lucky, for just themselves. But what about for everybody else? So this is a way to get 360 degree feedback from your whole team 365 days of the year. And it can be really scary. I want to acknowledge that, you know, getting these ratings, these scores, as it were, can be an intimidating moment when you're going, wow, this is how the world sees me? Oh man, that's not how I expected. But it's also a great opportunity for growth. And so for me, seeing some of my, I would say, flaws that I didn't think were flaws, I was like, wow, that's painful. That's that's really tough. but also allows me to see, oh, there's room for growth here. Maybe I can work on listening better. Maybe I can work on, it gave me an opportunity to really, truly grow as a leader.
You're currently writing your book, Instinct, which is an accumulation of your life's work. What can readers expect?
They can expect to see how instincts rule their lives. So the whole book is based around the idea that if we are not consciously aware and checking our behaviors, our instincts are going to drive us into less than optimal performance, less than optimal productivity, and really pretty poor choices for the modern world. So our brains truly are not built for this world. They're built for sort of the Stone Age, the ancestral world, because while culture and population size and all of these things have exponentially increased, biology operates a lot more slowly. And so we're stuck with brains that just can't process this modern world as quickly as we might hope, which means we react most of the time out of instincts. And these instincts were programmed for the Stone Age. So unfortunately, I go through 7 instincts, from survival, sex, variety, self-delusion, belonging, fear of the other, and information collecting. And all of these instincts were super useful to help us to survive in the ancestral world. And today they prevent us from fully living. So I hope to offer all of my readers some solutions and some workarounds to help have their biology work for them rather than against them.
There's a lot of fear out there when it comes to COVID-19. It's invisible. We haven't, as a society, experienced anything like this since the Spanish flu, and there is so much loss. What is your advice to listeners about overcoming that instinctive fear and how they can lean into that discomfort and push on?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you for asking it. I think for all of us, we have to practice sorting our fears. And when I say sorting our fears, I mean recognizing what we can and cannot control. Unfortunately, our brains are built for this immediate life and death situation, and like a tiger jumping out from behind the bushes. And so when we get stressed, when we have a stress response, it's only to solve that immediate life-threatening situation of a tiger. Our bodies and brains have no way to cope with a pandemic, no way to cope with these ongoing stressors of modern life. And so what we have to do is sort out, okay, a stress response in this situation, having high cortisol, having an increased heart rate, having anxiety isn't useful. So what can I do in this situation? Well, I can wash my hands. I can stay at home. I can take long breaths and use my conscious mind, my frontal lobe, rather than letting my anxieties, my reactionary portion of my brain take control and drive me towards behaviors and decisions that aren't actually helping me. So sorting out those fears of what I can control in this situation and what I cannot is going to be really important. And leaning into that discomfort is really about recognizing that there are a lot of things that aren't in our control right now, and that's okay. We have to sit in that discomfort for a bit, knowing that things will emerge, things will change, and we will all ultimately be okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Yeah, I hope that all of you will please come visit the site, leave comments, recognize the massive amount of lives that have been claimed by this horrific pandemic, and do your part. You know, be willing to share the site, be willing to share it with people that have lost members of their family, be willing to share it with people that haven't, that can just go on and sort of take a moment of pause to recognize how real this is and hopefully prevent anything like this from ever happening again by being willing to do everything that we can to protect fellow Americans.
That was evolutionary behaviorist Rebecca Heiss speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about MourningAmerica.org, a free online platform to honor loved ones who died during the coronavirus pandemic. MourningAmerica.org's tagline is "More Than a Number." LaShawna Brunson-Smith says the $1,200 federal stimulus check won't be much of a help making up for the income she's losing during the coronavirus. Brunson-Smith is owner of Ladies Hair Design on Castle Street in Wilmington, North Carolina. And since Governor Roy Cooper ordered the shutdown at the end of March of hair salons and gyms and theaters and more, she's been out of work.
Been working and doing hair basically all my life. Just got put out of work due to the coronavirus. I know a lot of people is in my position, you know, my predicament where you might not have a 401k. You basically working from day to day, and by you not having bringing an income in, you don't have the finances to pay your bills, get gas. My girls, they dance. I have tuition to pay for dance and get food. It's just a burden on us, you know. Especially here in Wilmington, the rent has gone up so drastically high that people cannot afford it. Families are having to live together like two, three generations because rent is so high, but your pay isn't, you know, going up. Everything's going up, but your pay. Say, for instance, they give me or the average person the $1,200, the majority of it's going to go for rent, or, and, you know, you might get some food or you might pay another bill, but it's not going to help if I'm out of work over 30 days because, you know, that $1,200 is going to be gone before you even get it. I just don't want to sit and just be handed things. I'm used to working, and that's what I prefer to do. Sometimes, you know, I'll have my little niece, and she just brightens up my house because her mother is considered an essential worker, and my 12-year-old, she thinks she's Martha Stewart. She's been cooking, like, dishes, you know, she'll find online, and sometimes I'll get on Facebook, and people are putting positive things up, and some things are sad, but, you know, just try to encourage one another and stay alert and focus and try to be safe, just knowing that we're going to come. You know, it's going to be a time when it dies down and everything going to kind of get back to normal, but it's going to take some time.
This was broadcast from the Working Narrative Studio as part of a series that compiles community stories about COVID-19 from coastal North Carolina. Other families also are struggling financially because of the coronavirus pandemic. Military families face challenges of their own. The pandemic has placed burdens on younger military families who were already struggling to make ends meet. From San Diego, California, Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
Laura White is working in the back room of a storefront office in San Diego.
So we're putting our information on all these sleeves of diapers so when they get them, they know who they came from and if we can help.
White's group, STEP, counsels members of the military in financial trouble. In recent weeks, a lot of their effort has gone into providing care packages with basic necessities to families caught off guard by coronavirus.
What we're seeing is definitely a little bit of panic, as we all are kind of feeling these days, but another level with our military families, because they have some stricter stay-at-home rules. You know, when your spouse is deployed and you're still a parent, we don't want that parent here to get sick.
So they're delivering to single parents who are often living far from their own extended families. In late March, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper imposed a 60-day stop movement order throughout the world. At least 90,000 service members were caught up in the restriction. People were frozen in place. Kathleen Martinez's husband is a Marine officer at Camp Pendleton, north of San Diego. He was supposed to deploy overseas for the first time. Now that's on hold.
We were planning to have me go live back in the Midwest while he's deployed to be near family because it is the first deployment. I'm a little nervous about it. We don't have any family or support system out here, so we thought that would be a smart idea.
In San Diego, where vacancy rates remain low, their lease will run out at the end of the month. They can continue to lease month to month, but their landlord has already told her it will be significantly more expensive.
Feel stuck, uncertain. Everything is up in the air. I'm a planner, and I can't plan right now, so that's a little nerve-wracking, just not knowing what's next.
The secretary's order came down so quickly, some families were stuck mid-move. Some arrived in San Diego before their furniture. Other sailors and Marines had set up their new places and were ready to move when the order came down. Blue Star Families, a military support group, is asking families about the disruption caused by COVID-19 and the military's response. Jessica Strong is the senior researcher for the survey.
Because this stop movement order, people are not able to move from one place to another. If you were caught in the middle of that right now, 21% of our respondents in our week one said that they will be paying two rents or mortgages in the next 60 days. After they've just lost a position or lost half their income, that's not easy to do.
By the second week of the survey, 37% of respondents said their spouse had become unemployed. About a third say they plan to dip into savings.
there's a lot of financial repercussions. People are without housing or unable to make rent or unable to afford food even.
Laura White with the group that helps military families says denial plays a big role in compounding financial problems. She's seen people stack unopened bills when they know they can't pay.
We want you to take a deep breath and realize that a big part of the world has just come to a halt. So you're not in any different situation than a lot of other people. Get them in order and start making phone calls to each one of those people and talk about your situation. You're going to be able to put something on hold. You're going to be able to come up with some payment plans.
If a creditor won't work with you, the next step is to contact state or federal consumer protection offices. New laws have put temporary holds on some evictions. People in the military should also reach out to their command. Above all else, White says, try to stay calm. There are solutions. In San Diego, I'm Steve Walsh.
And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns reflects on Passover during COVID-19.
One of my family's favorite annual rituals happens in spring. We celebrate Passover. And every year we have a Seder in our home with a family that also shares our exact demographics. Jewish moms, homeschooled sons who are now college grads, and Christian dads. Over the years, there's been a sprinkling of others who've come and gone, like girlfriends, various relatives, and friends. But this is the spring of 2020, and we couldn't do our usual Seder. We considered holding it via video conference, but then we thought more about it. The Passover Seder celebrates a people's crossing out of bondage into freedom. We decided it would be very meaningful for us all to do it face to face around an actual table after our release from the bondage of self-isolation and fanatical hand-washing. Still, Passover is an important holiday, and if ever there was a time we wanted something to pass over our homes, it was this one. So the three of us, my husband, Barry, my son, Zach, and I decided to do a little Seder. Just us. We planned a shopping list to make it possible. Now, Barry does our every 10-day shopping trip, and he went on Monday of Passover week. Matzah, check. Matzah meal for matzah ball soup, check. Organic chicken, check. We have greens, asparagus, and potatoes for kugel, all check. Because I'm an adjunct college instructor getting my suddenly online classes into shape and helping students adjust to a new educational reality, the first night of the actual holiday wasn't going to work. We decided to do our Seder on Thursday, the second night. And then I realized something crucial. I forgot to put horseradish on the shopping list. So we raided the fridge. Sure enough, there was a jar of horseradish there, but it looked like it was from Passover 2012. Then we thought, no problem, we'll run to a store and buy a jar of horseradish. We'll be in and out of the store in a heartbeat. And then we thought differently. In the new millennium's version of BC, you know, before Corona, zipping into a store to buy a single item was a no-brainer. A 15-minute drive to a supermarket, a quick run to the dairy case, and we'd be back in a snap. But we're not living in BC times. We are now living in the time of Corona, and everything is different. If Barry goes to a grocery store, it exposes others to him. It also exposes him to others. And for what? A single jar of horseradish? We wanted to make do, but horseradish is pretty key in the Passover celebration. In addition to its symbolic connection to the harsh bitterness of slavery, it's an iconic Seder flavor. It features prominently in a signature Seder dish called the Hillel sandwich. And to make one, you generously slather a piece of matzah with an apple raisin walnut pate called haroset. Then you top it off with horseradish, which is the salsa of Jewish cuisine. Because the Hillel sandwich is the best part of the Seder, it really needs horseradish in all its nasal clearing glory. But going to the market to get it felt wrong. That kind of behavior is an old behavior, a BC behavior. Continuing that behavior wouldn't help flatten the curve. So we got creative. We realized we could buy horseradish root at a nearby natural food store and have them set it outside for us to pick up. We'd never even have to enter the store. That'd work. A friend said we could have her leftover horseradish root after her Seder. Well, that could work too. But there was a little problem with those solutions, at least for me. We are all about homemade foods, but there is just something about jarred horseradish that speaks childhood memories for me. I mean, we could make do and make it ourselves, of course, but the jar still called me. And then I had another idea to try. I texted various friends to see if they had a shopping trip planned. And one friend was making her weekly masked sojourn to the supermarket the very next day. So she bought a jar of horseradish on her trip, and she left it for us on her porch. Barry went to pick it up. Everything was different, but nobody spent the extra time going into a supermarket. Now, this coronavirus health crisis has changed the world in horrible ways. But is curtailing our driving trips a horrible thing? I mean, one person skipping a shopping trip doesn't really sound like much, but the reduction in people's movement really does add up. When people sheltered at home in China, the drop in transportation use improved the air quality. The New York Times reports that people in India are currently able to marvel at a clear blue sky instead of a polluted haze. Furthermore, air pollution has been reduced in Germany, Los Angeles, Korea, and many other places. It seems that reduced carbon emissions really impacts the environment. Now, a pandemic is clearly not good, as we're all painfully aware. While stay-at-home orders aren't a sustainable way of life, the choices we make can be. Maybe the way corona is changing us can be a force that impacts human behavior, which in turn impacts the earth for good. It certainly changed my family's behavior during the spring 2020 horseradish hunt, and it's a habit I plan to carry forth into the AC, or after corona time.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1605.